Antiquities, Book 12. How Ptolemy, son of Lagus, took Jerusalem and Judea by trickery and deceit, and resettled many of its people in Egypt. How his son Ptolemy, called Philadelphus, translated the laws of the Jews into the Greek language, and released many prisoners as a favor to Eleazar their high priest, and dedicated many offerings to God. How the kings of Asia honored the Jewish nation and made its people citizens, settling them in the cities they founded. The recovery from the disaster that had befallen them, brought about by Joseph, son of Tobias, who made friendship with Ptolemy called Epiphanes. The friendship and alliance of the Spartans with Onias, the high priest of the Jews. The factional strife among the powerful men of the Jews and how they called in Antiochus Epiphanes. How Antiochus, marching against Jerusalem, took the city and plundered the temple. How, when Antiochus forbade the Jews to observe their ancestral laws, only Mattathias, son of Asamoneus, defied the king and defeated Antiochus's generals. The death of Mattathias, already an old man, after he had handed over the leadership of affairs to his sons. How his son Judas, after fighting Antiochus's generals, brought the Jews back to their ancestral constitution and was appointed high priest by the people. How Apollonius, Antiochus's general, invaded Judea and was defeated and killed. The campaign of Sayan and Gorgias against Judea, their defeat, and the dissension in their army. How Judas campaigned against the Ammonites and conquered as far as Gilead. How his brother Simon campaigned against Tyre and Ptolemais and defeated them. The campaign of Lysias, Antiochus's general, against the Jews and his defeat. How Antiochus Epiphanes died in Persia. How Antiochus, surnamed Eupator, campaigning against the Jews together with Lysias, won the battle and besieged Judas, shutting him up in the temple. How, after the siege had dragged on a long time, Antiochus made peace with Judas and withdrew from Judea on honorable terms. How Bacchides, Demetrius's general, campaigned against the Jews and returned to the king having accomplished nothing. How Nicanor, sent as general after Bacchides, perished together with his army. How Bacchides, sent out again against Judea, won. How Judas was killed in battle. This book covers a period of 170 years. Alexander, king of the Macedonians, having overthrown the Persian Empire and settled affairs in Judea in the manner just described, ended his life. When the empire passed into the hands of many, Antigonus held Asia, Seleucus held Babylon and the nations there, Lysimachus governed the Hellespont, Cassander held Macedonia, and Ptolemy, son of Lagus, had taken Egypt. As these men quarreled and vied with one another for their own dominion, continuous and lengthy wars resulted, and the cities suffered, losing many of their inhabitants in the fighting, so that all Syria, under Ptolemy, son of Lagus, then styled Soter, savior, suffered the very opposite of what his title promised. This man took Jerusalem too, by trickery and deceit. He entered the city on the Sabbath as if to sacrifice, and since the Jews offered him no resistance, for they suspected nothing hostile, and because of their unsuspecting nature, and because the day found them at leisure and rest, he gained control of the city without effort and ruled it harshly. Agatharchides of Cnidus, who wrote the history of the successors, bears witness to this account, reproaching us for a superstition that, he says, cost us our freedom in these words. There is a people called the Jews, who, though they possessed a strong and great city, Jerusalem, let it fall under Ptolemy's power because they refused to take up arms, but through their ill-timed superstition endured having a harsh master. This, then, is what Agatharchides declared about our nation. Ptolemy, having taken many captives from the hill country of Judea, from the region around Jerusalem, and from Samaria, and from the people at Gerizim, settled them all in Egypt, bringing them there. Knowing that the men of Jerusalem were most steadfast in keeping oaths and pledges of loyalty, as had become clear from their answer to Alexander, when he sent an embassy to them after defeating Darius in battle, he enrolled many of them in garrisons, and having granted the Macedonians in Alexandria equal citizenship, took oaths from them as well, that they would keep faith with the descendants of those to whom this trust had been given. Not a few other Jews also came to Egypt, drawn by the richness of the land and by Ptolemy's generosity. Disputes did arise, however, between their descendants and the Samaritans, who wished to preserve the ancestral practice of their customs, and they made war on one another, the people of Jerusalem maintaining that their own temple was the holy one and that sacrifices should be sent there, while the men of Shechem insisted on Mount Gerizim. Alexander reigned 12 years, and after him Ptolemy Soter for 41. Then Philadelphus received the kingdom of Egypt and held it for 39 years, during which he translated the law and freed those of the people of Jerusalem enslaved in Egypt, about 120,000 of them, for the following reason. Demetrius of Phalerum, who was in charge of the king's libraries, was eager, if it could be done, to gather together all the books in the world. And he bought up anything he heard was worth having, in accordance with the king's own wish, for he too took great pleasure in the collecting of books, and gave the project his full support. Once, when Ptolemy asked him how many tens of thousands of volumes he had already collected, he answered that there were about 200,000 in hand, and that in a short time he would bring the total to 500,000. He said he had also been informed that many writings existed among the Jews as well, worthy of note and belonging to their own laws, and worth having for the king's library, but that, being written in their own characters and in their own dialect, they would give no small trouble to translate into the Greek tongue. For their script appeared, in its particular form, similar to that of the Syrians, and their language sounded like it as well, yet it had turned out to be a distinct tongue of its own. Nothing, then, he said, prevented having these two translated, since the king was well supplied with the funds needed for the purpose, so that the library might contain their writings as well. The king, judging Demetrius's proposal for increasing the number of his books to be excellent, wrote to the high priest of the Jews that this should be carried out. Now a certain Aristeas, a particularly close friend of the king and held by him in high regard for his moderation, had often before resolved to entreat the king to release the Jewish captives held throughout his kingdom. And, judging this a fitting occasion for his request, he first raised the matter with the chief bodyguards, Sosibius of Tarentum and Andreas, asking them to support him in what he intended to put before the king. Having won their agreement as well, Aristeas came before the king and addressed him in these words. "We ought not, O king, deceive ourselves and overlook the matter, but bring out the truth. Since we have resolved not only to have the laws of the Jews transcribed, but also translated, to please you, by what reasoning could we justify this while so many Jews remain enslaved in your kingdom? Act in keeping with your own greatness of soul and generosity, and free them from their misery, since the God who gave them their laws watches over your kingdom, as I have learned through careful inquiry of my own. For the God who established all things is worshipped by them and by us alike, though we call him Zeus, giving him that name rightly, from his causing life to exist in all things. For this reason, in honor of God, restore to their homeland those who have made their worship of him their particular calling, and to the life they left behind there. Know, however, O king, that I make this request for them, though I am neither related to them by descent nor of their people, but because all men alike are creatures of God. And knowing that he takes pleasure in those who do good, I urge you to this as well." When Aristeas had said this, the king looked up at him with a cheerful and delighted expression and said, "How many tens of thousands do you suppose there will be of those set free?" Andreas, who stood beside him, answered that there would be a little more than 110,000. "Then it is a small gift you ask of us, Aristeas," said the king. When Sosibius and the others present said that it would befit him, in his greatness of soul, to make a thank offering to the God who had granted him his kingdom, he was moved by their words and gave orders that, whenever the soldiers' pay was dispersed, 120 drachmas be paid for each of the Jewish captives in their possession. And concerning what had been asked of him, he promised to issue a decree, magnificent in its terms, confirming both Aristeas's proposal and, prior to it, the will of God, by which he declared he would free not only those brought in by his father and his father's army, but also those already present in the kingdom before them, and any who might yet be brought in. When it was reckoned that the ransom would amount to more than 400 talents, he agreed to this as well, and it was decided to preserve a copy of the decree as a record of the king's magnanimity. It read as follows: "As many as, campaigning with our father in Syria and Phoenicia, and after subduing Judea, took captives and brought them to our cities and country and sold them there, together with those who were already in my kingdom before them and any now brought in. Let those who hold them release them, receiving for each person 120 drachmas, the soldiers together with their military pay, the rest receiving the ransom from the royal treasury. For I consider that they were taken captive against my father's intention and against what is right, that their country has been ravaged through the soldiers' license, and that their removal to Egypt has brought great profit to the soldiers. Having regard, therefore, for justice, and taking pity on men wronged beyond what is fitting, I order the release of the Jews now held in servitude, their owners receiving the sum stated above for each. And let no one deal wrongfully with them in this matter, but let all obey what has been ordered. I wish the registration to be completed within 3 days of the issuing of this decree, before the officials set over them, with the persons themselves presented at once. For I judge this to serve my own interest. Let anyone who wishes report those who disobey, whose property I wish to be confiscated to the royal estate. When this decree was read to the king, and found complete in every respect except that it had not made explicit provision for the Jews brought in earlier and those brought in later, he himself, out of his own magnanimity, added this further act of kindness as well, and ordered that the sum owed, though a single lump payment, be apportioned among the officials of the treasury and the royal bankers. When this had been done, within 7 days in all what the king had decreed was accomplished, and the ransom came to more than 460 talents, for the owners exacted the 120 drachmas even for infants, since the king had ordered payment for them too, in prescribing that this sum be received for each person. Once this had been carried out magnificently, in accordance with the king's wish, he ordered Demetrius to submit his proposal concerning the transcription of the Jewish books as well. For kings did nothing without careful consideration, but conducted everything with great diligence. For this reason, both the copy of the proposal and of the letters have been preserved, together with a record of the offerings that were sent and the workmanship of each, so that the craftsmen's skill might be perfectly evident to those who saw them, and so that, by the excellence of what was made, the maker of each piece might at once be recognized. The copy of the proposal was as follows: To the great king, from Demetrius. Since you have ordered, O king, concerning the writings still needed to complete the library, that they be gathered, and concerning those that have fallen into decay, that they receive proper care, I, having applied every diligence to this task, report to you that the books of the Jewish legislation are lacking to us, along with certain others. For being written in Hebrew characters and in the language of that nation, they are unintelligible to us. It has also happened that they have been copied out rather more carelessly than they should have been, since they have not received royal attention. It is necessary that these two be made accurate and kept in your possession, for their legislation, being God's, turns out to be highly philosophical and pure. For this reason Hecateus of Abdera says that neither the poets nor the writers of histories made any mention of it, nor of the men who governed themselves by it, since it is holy and ought not to be disclosed by profane lips. If then it seems good to you, O king, you should write to the high priest of the Jews, asking him to send 6 elders from each tribe, the men most experienced in the laws, from whom, once we have learned the clear and consistent sense of the books and secured an accurate rendering of their content, we may compile them in a manner worthy of your purpose. This proposal having been submitted, the king ordered that a letter be written to Eleazar, the high priest of the Jews, concerning these matters, informing him at the same time of the release of the Jews enslaved among his people. And for the making of bowls, phials, and libation vessels, he sent 50 talents weight of gold and precious stones in a quantity beyond counting. He also ordered the guards of the chests in which the stones were kept to allow the craftsmen a free choice of whatever kind they wished. He also arranged that coin worth 100 talents be given to the priest for sacrifices and other needs. I will describe the objects made, and the manner of their craftsmanship, after first setting out the copy of the letter written to Eleazar the high priest, who received this honor for the following reason. When Onias the high priest died, his son Simon became his successor. He was called the Just for his piety toward God and his goodwill toward his countrymen. When he died and left an infant son named Onias, his brother Eleazar, The man this account concerns took over the high priesthood. To him, Ptolemy wrote in these terms, King Ptolemy to Eleazar the high priest, greetings. Since many Jews are settled in my kingdom, men whom my father honored after they were taken captive by the Persians when the Persians held power, enrolling some of them in the army at higher pay and entrusting others, who had come to Egypt with him, with the garrisons and their guarding, so that they would be feared by the Egyptians. I, on taking over the throne, have treated everyone with kindness, and especially your countrymen. Of these, I have freed more than 100,000 who were held as slaves, paying their master's ransom from my own funds. Those in the prime of life I have enrolled in the military register, and some of those capable of being trusted at court I have judged worthy of that trust, believing this to be a pleasing offering to God for his providence toward me, and the greatest one I could make. Wishing to show favor to these men and to all the Jews throughout the world, I have resolved to have your law translated, transcribed from Hebrew into Greek characters, and deposited in my library. You will therefore do well to select good men, 6 from each tribe, already advanced in years, who by reason of their age have expert knowledge of the laws and will be able to produce an accurate translation of them. For I think that when this is accomplished, we shall win the greatest renown. I have sent to confer with you about these matters, Andreas, the chief bodyguard, and Aristeas, men held in the highest honor by me, through whom I have also sent 100 talents of silver as first fruits for offerings to the temple and for sacrifices and other needs. And you, for your part, will do us a favor by writing to us about whatever you wish. When the king's letter was delivered to Eleazar, he wrote back to it with all the goodwill he could muster. The high priest Eleazar to King Ptolemy, greetings. If you and Queen Arsinoe and your children are in good health, all is well with us. On receiving your letter, we rejoiced greatly at your intention, and we gathered the people and read it to them, showing them the piety you hold toward God. We also displayed to them the bowls you sent, 20 of gold and 30 of silver, and 5 mixing bowls, and a table for dedication, together with the 100 talents for sacrifice, and for whatever repairs the temple might need, all of which Andreas and Aristeas, the most honored of your friends, brought, men of quality, distinguished in learning and worthy of your virtue. Know that we will endure whatever serves your interest, even if it goes against nature, for we owe it to repay your benefactions, which have been bestowed so abundantly on our citizens. At once, then, we offered sacrifices on behalf of you, your sister, your children, and your friends, and the people made prayers that things might go according to your mind, and that your kingdom might be kept in peace, and that the translation of the law might reach the completion you intend, to your advantage. I have also selected elders, 6 men from each tribe, whom we have sent with the law in hand. It will be a mark of your piety and justice to send the translated law back to us in safety, under the protection of those who bring it. Farewell. This is what the high priest wrote in reply. I did not think it necessary to give the names of the 70 elders who were sent by Eleazar carrying the law, for these were recorded in the letter itself. But the costliness and workmanship of the offerings which the king sent to God, I thought it not unfitting to describe, so that the king's devotion toward God might be made plain to everyone. For in furnishing unstinting expense for this purpose, and by being present continually with the craftsmen and overseeing the work, the king allowed none of the pieces to be made carelessly or casually. I will now describe the costliness of each item, though the history perhaps does not require such a report. Still, I take it that the king's love of beauty and his magnanimity will thereby be made evident to my readers. First, I will set out the details of the table. The king had it in mind to make this piece of work of the very largest dimensions, and he ordered that the size of the table dedicated at Jerusalem be ascertained, how large it was, and whether a larger one could be made. On learning what its actual size was, and that nothing prevented a larger one from being made, he said he wished to have one made 5 times the size of the existing one, but feared that it might become unfit for its ritual use because of its excessive size. For he wished the offerings not merely to be set up for display, but also to be serviceable for the rites. And so, reasoning that the earlier table had been made of a proportionate size, not for lack of gold, he resolved not to exceed the existing one in size, but to make his more remarkable for the variety and beauty of its material. being skilled at grasping the nature of every kind of object and at conceiving new and extraordinary designs, and for whatever had not been recorded in writing supplying the invention himself through his own understanding and showing it to the craftsmen, he ordered these things to be made, and directed that whatever had been written down should likewise be carried out with precision, keeping to the record. Having thus undertaken to make the table 2.5 cubits in length, 1 cubit in width, and 1.5 cubits in height, they worked it entirely of gold, laying the whole foundation of the piece in that material. They made the crown molding a palm's breadth wide, and wrought the wave moldings as twisted cable patterns, marvelously rendered in relief on all three sides. For since these were triangular in shape, each angle bore the same pattern of relief, so that as they were turned, the same design, and not a different one, revolved with them. Of the crown molding, the part inclined beneath the table had a beautiful relief pattern, while the outer, projecting part had been worked with still greater beauty of craftsmanship, since it came directly under view and observation. For this reason, the raised edges of both parts turned out sharp, and no one of the three angles, as we said before, appeared smaller than the others as the table was turned. Set into the cable-patterned reliefs were costly stones arranged in parallel rows, held fast by golden pins through drilled holes. Along the sides of the crown molding, rising toward view, an ornament of eggs made from the finest stone had been set in place, worked in relief to resemble close-set rods running around the circle of the table. Beneath the pattern of the eggs, the craftsmen carried around a wreath engraved in the likeness of every kind of fruit, so that clusters of grapes seemed to hang down, ears of grain to stand upright, and pomegranates to be enclosed within their husks. They worked the stones to match every kind of these fruits, so that each bore its own natural color, and fastened them with gold all around the whole table. Below the wreath, in the same way, was set the pattern of the eggs and the relief of fluting, so that on both sides of the table, the same display of variety and elegance of workmanship was achieved, with the arrangement of the other wave moldings and of the crown molding showing no difference even when the table was turned to face the other way, the same appearance of craftsmanship extending even down to the feet. For they made a plate of gold 4 fingers wide running the whole width of the table, and into this they set the table's legs. Then with pins and clasps they fastened these to the table at the crown molding, so that whichever side the table were set to face, it would present the same appearance of novelty and costliness. On the table itself, they engraved a meander pattern, setting into its center notable stones like stars of varied form, the carbuncle and the emerald each casting a most pleasing gleam upon those who looked on them, along with stones of the other kinds that are prized and coveted by all for the costliness of their nature. After the meander came a cable-like plated pattern running around, resembling a lozenge in its central appearance, into which crystal and amber had been set, their alternating juxtaposition producing a marvelous delight for those who beheld it. The capitals of the legs were shaped like lilies, with the unfolding of the petals curving back beneath the table while allowing the upward growth to be seen from within. The base beneath them was made of carbuncle stone, a palm's breadth in size, forming the shape of a plinth and 8 fingers wide, on which the whole plate of the legs rested. They carved each of the legs with fine and most painstaking relief work, bringing out on them ivy and vine tendrils together with clusters of grapes, so lifelike that one would judge them to fall nothing short of reality. For through their fineness, and through the way their outermost extensions moved in the breeze, they created an impression more of things by nature in motion than of imitations by art. They devised the whole shape of the table as if triple paneled, the parts fitted together in such harmony with one another that the joints were invisible and could not even be detected. The thickness of the table came to not less than 0.5 cubit. This offering, then, was completed through the king's great devotion, both in the costliness of its material, the variety of its beauty, and the craftsman's skill in relief work. The king having taken care that, even if it should not surpass in size the table already dedicated to God, it should in workmanship, novelty, and brilliance of construction be made far superior and an object of admiration. Of the mixing bowls, 2 were of gold, worked with scale-like relief from the base to the girdle, with stones of varied colors set into their spirals. Above this, a meander a cubit high was worked in a composition of every sort of stone, and upon it fluting was carved in relief, above which a lozenge-shaped lattice pattern, resembling netting, ran up to the rim. The spaces between were filled out in beauty by small shields of stone 4 fingers wide. The rim of the mixing bowl was wreathed round with lilies, bindweed, flowers, and clusters of grapes drawn together in cable patterns forming a circle. In this manner, the 2 golden mixing bowls, each holding 2 amphorae, were made, and the silver ones proved far more brilliant in their gleam than mirrors, so that the faces of those who approached them were seen more clearly reflected in them. The king also had 30 bowls made in addition to these, and whatever part of them was gold, rather than set with costly stone, was shaded with skillfully carved bindweed of ivy and vine leaves. These things were achieved partly through the skill of the workmen, who were marvelous in their art, but far more through the king's zeal and devotion, which brought them to completion beyond the ordinary. For he not only supplied the craftsmen with unstinting and generous funding, but, setting aside his attention to affairs of state, was himself present with those making the pieces and oversaw the whole work. This was the reason for the craftsmen's diligence, for looking to the king and his own zeal, they applied themselves to the work with greater industry. Such were the offerings sent to Jerusalem by Ptolemy. The high priest Eleazar dedicated them, honored the men who had brought them, gave gifts to carry back to the king, and sent them off to him. When they arrived in Alexandria, Ptolemy, hearing of their presence and that the 70 elders had come, at once sent for Andreas and Aristeas, the envoys. On their arrival, they delivered the letters they were carrying to him from the high priest, and reported all that they had been instructed to say. Eager to meet with the elders who had come from Jerusalem for the translation of the laws, he ordered that the others who happened to be present on various business be dismissed, an unusual step and contrary to custom. For those who came on such business were normally admitted to him only after 5 days, while envoys waited a month. Having thus dismissed the others, he waited for the men sent by Eleazar. When the elders arrived, bringing with them the gifts which the high priest had given them to carry to the king, along with the skins on which the laws were written in golden letters, he questioned them about the books. When they unwrapped the coverings and showed them to him, the king marveled at the fineness of the parchment and the imperceptibility of the joins. So skillfully had they been fitted together. And after doing this for a considerable time, he said he was grateful to them for coming, and even more to the one who had sent them, but above all to God, whose laws they turned out to be. When the elders and all present cried out together, wishing good things for the king, he broke into tears from the excess of his joy, for it is the nature of great gladness to produce the same signs as grief. Ordering that the books be given to the officials in charge of such matters, he then greeted the men, saying it was right first to speak of the business for which he had summoned them, and only then to address them personally. He further promised to make the day on which they had come to him a day of note, celebrated every year for the whole span of his life, since it happened to coincide with the anniversary of his victory over Antigonus in the sea battle. He also ordered them to dine with him, and directed that the finest lodgings near the citadel be given to them. Nicanor, who was in charge of receiving foreign guests, summoned Dorotheus, who had responsibility for such matters, and told him to prepare for each man what was needed for his manner of living. This had been arranged by the king in the following way. For every city that followed its own customs in matters of diet, Dorotheus took care of these things, and prepared everything for those who came to him according to the custom of their homeland, so that being entertained in their accustomed manner, they might enjoy themselves the more, and take no offense as if treated as strangers to anything. This same care was in fact shown to these men as well. Dorotheus had been put in charge of these matters because of his exactness in the conduct of life. Through him, everything needed for such receptions was arranged, and he made the couches in 2 rows, as the king had ordered. Half the men were to recline on one side, the rest after the king's own couch, so that nothing was wanting in the honor paid to the men. Once they were seated in this way, the king told Dorotheus to serve them according to the customs that all who came to him from Judea regularly observed. For this reason, he dismissed the sacred heralds and the sacrificers and the others who normally offered the invocations, and instead asked one of the visitors, a priest named Eliseus, to say the blessing. He stood in the middle and prayed for the king's welfare and for that of his subjects. Then applause rose from everyone with joy and shouting, and when it ceased, they turned to the feast and to enjoying what had been prepared. After the king judged that enough time had passed, he began to converse philosophically and put questions of natural science to each of them in turn, asking each man in turn to speak with precision on whatever topic was proposed for inquiry. He took delight in their answers to whatever was put to them, and kept the banquet going for 12 days, so that anyone who wants to learn the particulars of what was discussed at the banquet can do so by reading the book of Aristeus, which he wrote for this purpose. The king, and Menedemus the philosopher too, marveled at them, declaring that everything is governed by providence, and that this was likely why such power and beauty had been found in their reasoning as well. When they ceased being questioned on these matters, the king said the greatest of blessings had already come to him through their presence, for he had profited by learning from them how a king ought to rule. He ordered that 3 talents be given to each of them, along with attendants to escort them back to their lodging. 3 days later, Demetrius took them, and after crossing the 7-stayed causeway from the sea to the island and passing over the bridge, he went on to the northern district and held a meeting in the house built beside the shore, a place well suited to quiet reflection on matters of business. Bringing them there, he urged them to carry out the work of translating the law without hindrance, since everything they might need for the interpretation was at hand. They then, with all the ambition and diligence they could bring to making the translation exact, continued at the task until the 9th hour, after which they turned to the care of the body, being generously supplied with everything needed for their diet. Dorotheus, moreover, supplied them liberally, for the king had ordered it, with much of what was being prepared for himself. Early each morning, they came to the court, greeted Ptolemy, and then went back to the same place. And after washing their hands in the sea and purifying themselves, they turned to the interpretation of the laws. When the law had been transcribed, and the work of translation had reached completion in 72 days, Demetrius gathered all the Jews at the place where the laws had been translated, with the translators present, and read the translation to them. The people welcomed the elders who had made the law clear, and they praised Demetrius as well for having conceived so great a benefit for them, and asked that he give their leaders 2 a reading of the law. All of them requested it, the priest, the elders among the translators, and the leaders of the community, since the translation had been so well finished that it should remain as it stood and not be altered. When everyone had approved this resolution, they further ordered that if anyone noticed anything added to or omitted from the law, he should examine it again, and, once he had made it clear, correct it, acting prudently in this so that what had once been judged good might remain forever unchanged. The king rejoiced to see his purpose brought to so useful a completion, and still more, once the laws had been read to him, he was struck with wonder at the intelligence and the wisdom of the lawgiver, and began to put a question to Demetrius. How was it that, the legislation being so admirable, no historian and no poet had ever made mention of it? Demetrius answered that no one had dared to undertake a written account of these laws, because they were divine and holy, and that some who had already attempted it had been harmed by God. He explained that Theopompus, wishing to relate something about them, had his mind disturbed for more than 30 days, and that in the intervals of relief he kept propitiating God, since he suspected that this was the source of his derangement. He had even seen in a dream that this had happened to him, because he was prying into divine things and wished to publish them to ordinary people. And having drawn back, his mind was restored. Demetrius also reported a similar story told of Theodectes, the tragic poet, who, wishing to make mention in one of his dramas of things written in the sacred book, was struck blind in his eyes, and once he understood the cause, recovered from his affliction by appeasing God. Once the king had received these things from Demetrius, as has already been said, he bowed before the books and ordered that great care be taken of them, so that they might be preserved uncorrupted, and he invited the translators to come to him from Judea regularly, since this would benefit them both in the honor he would show them and in the profit from his gifts. For now, he said, it was only right to send them off, But if they came to him of their own accord in the future, they would obtain everything that their wisdom justly deserved, and that his own generosity was able to provide. He then sent them off, giving each man 3 fine robes, 2 talents of gold, a cup worth a talent, and the couch furnishings from the banquet. These gifts he bestowed on them. And to the high priest Eleazar he sent, by their hands, 10 couches with silver feet and their accompanying furnishings, a cup worth 30 talents. And besides these 10 robes, purple cloth, a splendid crown, 100 rolls of fine linen, and further bowls, dishes, libation vessels, and 2 gold mixing bowls for dedication. He also urged him, in letters, that if any of these men wished to come to him, he should permit it, since he set great store by the company of educated men and was glad to spend his wealth on such people. Such, then, were the honors that came to the Jews from Ptolemy Philadelphus for the glory and dignity of their nation. They also received honor from the kings of Asia, since they had fought alongside them. For Seleucus Nicator granted them citizenship in the cities he founded in Asia and Lower Syria, and in the capital itself, Antioch, and made them equal in privilege to the Macedonians and Greeks settled there, so that this citizenship still remains in force today. The proof of this is that the Jews, unwilling to use foreign oil, receive a fixed sum of money from the gymnasiarchs in place of the oil allowance, as he had ordered. When the people of Antioch wished to abolish this in the recent war, Mucianus, then governor of Syria, preserved it. And afterward, when Vespasian and his son Titus had become masters of the world, the people of Alexandria and Antioch petitioned that the rights of citizenship no longer remain in force for the Jews, but they did not succeed. From this one may recognize the fairness and generosity of the Romans, and especially of Vespasian and Titus. Although they had suffered greatly in the war against the Jews and were bitterly disposed toward them for not surrendering their weapons, but holding out in resistance to the very end, they took away none of their possessions under the citizenship described above. For they mastered both their earlier anger and the very great pleading of the peoples of Alexandria and Antioch, so that neither their favor toward these petitioners nor their hatred of wrongdoing directed against those they had fought moved them to abolish any of the ancient privileges belonging to the Jews. Rather, they said that those who had taken up arms against them and gone to war had paid the penalty. But they did not think it right to deprive those who had done no wrong of their possessions. We know that Marcus Agrippa held a similar view about the Jews. For when the Ionians rose up against them and pressed Agrippa that the Jews alone should be made to give up the citizenship that Antiochus, the grandson of Seleucus, called Theos among the Greeks, had granted them, on the ground that if the Jews were their kinsmen, they ought to worship their gods as well. And when the case concerning these matters was tried, the Jews won the right to keep their own customs, Nicolaus of Damascus having argued the case on their behalf. For Agrippa declared that it was not permitted to introduce any innovation against them. Anyone wishing to know the details may read Nicolaus's 123rd and 124th books. As for the judgments Agrippa made, there is perhaps nothing surprising in them, since our nation was not then at war with the Romans. But one might reasonably marvel at the generosity of Vespasian and Titus, who, after such wars and such great struggles as they had waged against us, still showed moderation. But let me return the narrative to the point from which I digressed. Under the reign of Antiochus the Great, king of Asia, the Jews happened to suffer greatly, their land being ravaged, along with those who inhabited Celesyria. For while he was at war with Ptolemy Philopater and afterward with his son, called Ptolemy Epiphanes, the Jews suffered the same hardships whether Antiochus was victorious or defeated, so that they were left in no better position than a ship tossed and battered by the waves from both sides, caught between Antiochus's good fortune and the turn of events against him. When, however, Antiochus defeated Ptolemy, he brought Judea over to his side. After the death of Philopater, his son sent out a great force under the general Scopas against the peoples of Celesyria, who took many of their cities, and our nation as well. For when war was made against it, it went over to him. Not long afterward, Antiochus defeated Scopas in battle at the springs of the Jordan and destroyed much of his army. Later, when Antiochus had subdued the cities in Celesyria that Scopas had held, along with Samaria, the Jews went over to him of their own accord, and, receiving him into their city, supplied his whole army and his elephants in abundance, and readily joined him in besieging the garrison Scopas had left in the citadel of Jerusalem. Antiochus, considering it right to reward the zeal and devotion the Jews had shown toward him, wrote to his generals and his friends, bearing witness to the good he had received from the Jews, and setting out the gifts he had resolved to grant them for it. I will set forth the letters written to the generals concerning them, after first noting, as Polybius of Megalopolis confirms our account in his 16th book, where he writes as follows. Scopas, the general of Ptolemy, marching up into the highlands, subdued the nation of the Jews during the winter. He says further in the same book that when Scopas was defeated by Antiochus, Antiochus took over Batania, Samaria, Abila, and Gadara. And shortly afterward, the Jews who dwelt around the temple called Jerusalem went over to him as well, about which, having much more to say, especially concerning the manifestation that occurred at the temple, I will postpone the account to another occasion. This is what Polybius recorded. Let us now return to the narrative, setting out first the letters of King Antiochus. King Antiochus to Ptolemy, greeting. Since the Jews, as soon as we entered their territory, showed their devotion toward us, and when we arrived at the city gave us a magnificent welcome, coming out to meet us with the Senate, providing abundant supplies for the soldiers and the elephants, and joining in driving out the Egyptian garrison in the citadel, we have judged it right to repay them in turn for this, to restore their city, ruined as it was by the misfortunes of the war, and to resettle it by gathering back those who had been scattered from it. First, out of regard for their piety, we have decided to provide for the sacrifices a grant of sacrificial animals, wine, oil, and frankincense worth 20,000 pieces of silver, and sacred fine flour in the amount of 1,460 measures according to the local law, and 375 measures of salt. I wish these things to be furnished to them, as I have ordered, and the work on the temple to be completed, including the porticos and whatever else needs to be built. The timber is to be brought in from Judea itself, from the other nations, and from Lebanon, with no tax levied on it, and likewise for the other materials needed to make the restoration of the temple the more splendid. Let all those of the nation govern themselves according to their ancestral laws, and let the Senate, the priests, the temple scribes, and the temple singers be released from the poll tax, the crown tax, and the tax on other things. And so that the city may be resettled more quickly, I grant to those now living there, and to those who return by the month of Hyperbarateos, exemption from taxes for up to 3 years. We also release them for the future from a third part of their tribute, so that the damage they have suffered may be made good. And as for those who were carried off from the city and are now enslaved, we set both them and their children free, and order that their property be restored to them. Such was the content of the letter. And to honor the temple further, he issued a public proclamation throughout the whole kingdom containing the following: that no foreigner should be permitted to enter the enclosure of the temple forbidden to non-Jews, except those for whom it is customary, once purified, according to the ancestral law. Nor into the know one shall bring horse meat or mule meat into the city, nor the meat of wild or domestic asses, leopards, foxes, or hares, nor in general any of the animals forbidden to the Jews. No one shall bring in their hides, nor even raise any of these animals in the city. Only the sacrificial animals of their ancestors, from which they must also offer sacrifice to God, are they permitted to use. Whoever transgresses any of these provisions shall pay the priests 3,000 silver drachmas. He also wrote, testifying to our piety and good faith, when he learned of the uprisings in Phrygia and Lydia, while he himself was in the upper satrapies at the time, ordering Zeuxis, his general, and one of his closest friends to send some of our people from Babylon into Phrygia. He wrote as follows: King Antiochus to Zeuxis his father, greetings. If you are well, it would be good. I myself am also in good health. Learning that the people of Lydia and Phrygia were rising up, I judged this to require serious attention. And after deliberating with my friends about what should be done, it was decided to transfer 2,000 Jewish households, with their property, from Mesopotamia and Babylonia to the forts and the most essential places. For I am persuaded that they will be loyal guardians of our interests because of their piety toward God. And I know, from the testimony borne to them by their ancestors, both their good faith and their eagerness in whatever they are asked to do. I wish, then, though the transfer is a laborious matter, that once they have given their pledge, they be allowed to use their own laws. And when you have brought them to the places named, you shall give each of them a plot of land for building houses, land for farming and for planting vines, and you shall exempt them from the produce of the soil for 10 years. Let grain also be measured out to them, until they receive the produce of the land, for the sustenance of their servants. And let those serving their needs also be given what is sufficient, so that, receiving our generosity, they may show themselves the more eager on our behalf. Take care of the nation as far as you are able, so that it is troubled by no one. Concerning the friendship of Antiochus the Great toward the Jews, let this testimony suffice for us. After this, Antiochus made friendship and a treaty with Ptolemy, and gave him his daughter Cleopatra in marriage, ceding to him Celesyria, Samaria, Judea, and Phoenicia as a dowry, so named. When the taxes were divided between the two kings, each of the notable men bought the right to collect taxes in his own homeland, and having gathered the assessed sum, paid it to the kings. At this time the Samaritans, being prosperous, did the Jews much harm, cutting up their land and carrying off people. This happened in the high priesthood of Onias. For when Eleazar died, his uncle Manasseh received the high priesthood, and after him, when he too had ended his life, Onias succeeded to the honor, being the son of the Simon called the Just. Simon was the brother of Eleazar, as I have said before. This Onias was small-minded and fond of money. And for this reason, failing to pay the tax on behalf of the people that his fathers had paid the kings from their own resources, 20 talents of silver, he provoked to anger King Ptolemy Euergetes, the father of Philopater. Ptolemy sent an envoy to Jerusalem accusing Onias of not paying the taxes, and threatened, if he did not receive them, to parcel out their land and send soldiers to settle it. On hearing this message from the king, the Jews were thrown into confusion, but Onias was moved by none of it, out of his love of money. But a certain Joseph, still young in years, but enjoying a reputation among the people of Jerusalem for dignity and foresight and justice. His father was Tobias, and his mother was the sister of Onias the high priest, who informed him of the envoy's arrival, since he happened to be away at the time in the village of Phocola, where he had his home, came into the city and rebuked Onias for not caring for the safety of the citizens, but wishing to expose the nation to danger for the sake of withholding money. When it was for that very money that Onias claimed to hold the leadership of the people and to have obtained the honor of the high priesthood. If you are so enamored of money, he said, that you can bear to see your homeland endangered on its account and your fellow citizens suffer whatever may come, then go to the king and beg him to release you from all the money owed or a part of it. When Onias answered that he had no wish to hold office at all, and was ready, if it were possible, to lay down the high priesthood, but that he would not go up to the king, since he cared nothing about the matter, Joseph asked him whether he would allow him to go as ambassador to Ptolemy on behalf of the nation. When Onias said he permitted it, Joseph went up to the temple, called the people together in assembly, and urged them not to be troubled or afraid on account of the negligence of his uncle Onias toward them, but to put aside their gloomy expectations and take heart, for he himself promised to go as ambassador to the king and persuade him that they were doing no wrong. When the people heard this, they thanked Joseph. He then went down from the temple, received the king's envoy as his guest, and after giving him lavish gifts and entertaining him generously for many days, sent him on his way to the king, telling him that he himself would follow. Indeed, the envoy had become even more eager for Joseph's arrival at the king's court, having urged and encouraged him to come to Egypt, and having promised that he would obtain from Ptolemy whatever he might ask, for he had come to love greatly Joseph's noble bearing and the dignity of his character. When the envoy arrived in Egypt, he reported to the king Onias's ingratitude and spoke of Joseph's excellence, and said that he was about to come to him to ask pardon for the multitude's offenses, for he was their patron. Indeed, he used such abundance of praise in speaking of the young man that he predisposed both the king and his wife Cleopatra to feel kindly toward Joseph even before he arrived. Joseph sent word to his friends in Samaria, borrowed money, and prepared what was needed for the journey, clothing, drinking vessels, and pack animals, equipping himself with about 20,000 drachmas worth, and arrived in Alexandria. It happened that at that very time, all the leading men from the cities of Syria and Phoenicia, along with the magistrates, were going up to bid for the tax farming, for the king sold it each year to the men of standing in each city. Seeing Joseph on the road, they mocked him for his poverty and plain dress. When he arrived in Alexandria and heard that Ptolemy was in Memphis, he went to meet him and joined him there. As the king was sitting in his carriage with his wife and with his friend Athenion, the same man who had gone as envoy to Jerusalem and had been Joseph's guest, Athenion, catching sight of him, at once made him known to the king, saying that this was the man about whom, on returning from Jerusalem, he had reported that he was a good and honorable young man. Ptolemy greeted him first of all and invited him to mount the carriage. When Joseph had taken his seat, the king began to complain of Onias's conduct. Joseph said, "Forgive him on account of his age, for it surely does not escape you that old men and infants happen to have the same understanding. But from us, the younger men, you shall have everything, so that you have no cause for complaint." Delighted by the young man's charm and wit, Ptolemy began to love him all the more, as if he had already been tested by experience, so that he ordered him to lodge in the palace and to dine daily at his own table. When the king came to Alexandria, the leading men of Syria, seeing Joseph seated beside him, took it badly. When the day arrived on which the taxes of the cities were to be sold, those who held the highest rank in their own homelands were bidding. The taxes of Celesyria, Phoenicia, Judea, and Samaria together were being assessed at 8,000 talents, when Joseph came forward and accused the bidders of conspiring to offer the king only a low price for the taxes. He himself promised to give double, and to send to the king the property of those who committed offenses against his interest, for this too was sold along with the taxes. The king, delighted to hear this and considering that it would increase his revenue, declared that the contract for the taxes would be awarded to him. When he asked whether Joseph also had guarantors, he answered most wittily, "I will give you good and honorable men whom you will not distrust." When the king asked who these were, he said, "You yourself, O king, and your wife, I give you both as guarantors, one for each half." Ptolemy laughed and granted him the taxes without requiring any sureties. This greatly grieved those who had come from the cities to Egypt, feeling themselves outdone, and they returned each to their own homeland in disgrace. Joseph, having received from the king 2,000 foot soldiers, for he had asked for some assistance, so as to be able to compel those in the cities who showed contempt, and having borrowed 500 talents in Alexandria from the king's friends, set out for Syria. Arriving at Ashkelon, he demanded the taxes from the people of Ashkelon, and when they were unwilling to give anything and even insulted him, he seized about 20 of their leading men, put them to death, and sent their property, amounting to 1,000 talents, to the king, informing him also of what had happened. Ptolemy, amazed at his spirit and praising what he had done, allowed him to do as he wished. When the Syrians heard of this, they were struck with terror, and having before them the harsh example of the men of Ashkelon put to death for their disobedience, they opened their gates and received Joseph eagerly and paid the taxes. When the people of Scythopolis also attempted to insult him and withhold the taxes they had been paying without dispute, he likewise put their leading men to death and sent their property to the king. Having gathered great sums of money and made large profits from the tax farming, he used what he had acquired to secure the position of power he now held, judging it wise to preserve, from his own resources, the foundation and basis of his present good fortune. He sent many gifts, discreetly, to the king and to Cleopatra, and to their friends, and to all the powerful men at court, buying their goodwill through these means. He enjoyed this good fortune for 22 years, becoming the father of 7 children by one wife, and of one more, named Hyacinthus, by the daughter of his brother Selymius. He married her under the following circumstances. Once, when he had joined his brother, who was going to Alexandria bringing his daughter, who was of marriageable age, in order to give her in marriage to one of the Jews of standing, and was dining at the king's table, a dancing girl of great beauty came into the banquet, and he fell in love with her. He revealed this to his brother, begging him, since the law forbade Jews to approach a foreign woman, to conceal the offense, and, acting as a good servant to him, to arrange things so as to satisfy his desire. His brother gladly took on the service, adorned his own daughter, and brought her to him by night and had her lie with him. Being drunk, he did not perceive the truth and lay with his brother's daughter. And this having happened repeatedly, he loved her all the more passionately. He said to his brother that he was risking his life by loving a dancing girl, whom the king would perhaps not allow him to have. His brother told him not to be anxious at all, but to enjoy the woman he loved without fear, and to have her as his wife. And he then made the truth known to him, saying that he had chosen rather to see his own daughter dishonored than to see him brought to shame. Joseph, praising him for his brotherly love, took his daughter as his wife, and had by her a son, Hyrcanus, as I have said before. When this boy was still 13 years old, he showed a natural courage and intelligence beyond his years, so that he was bitterly envied by his brothers, being far superior to them and likely to be resented. When Joseph wished to know which of his sons was best suited by nature for virtue, he sent each in turn to the men then reputed to be teachers. The rest, out of laziness and a lack of diligence for hard work, returned to him foolish and ignorant. But after them, he sent the youngest, Hyrcanus, giving him 300 yoke of oxen, and sent him a 2 days' journey into the wilderness to sow the land, having first hidden the yoke straps. When Hyrcanus arrived at the place and did not have the straps, he rejected the advice of the drovers, who counseled sending some men to his father to fetch the straps. Instead, judging that the time should not be wasted waiting for those who would be sent, he devised a plan both clever and beyond his years. He slaughtered 10 yoke of oxen, distributed the meat to the workers, and, cutting up their hides and making straps from them, bound the yokes with these. And in this way, having sown the land his father had assigned him, he returned to him. When his father saw him, he was filled with admiration for his spirit, and praising the sharpness of his mind and the boldness that went with it, he loved him all the more as his only true son, to the vexation of his brothers. When someone reported to him, at this same time, that a son had been born to King Ptolemy, and that all the leading men of Syria and of the subject country were setting out for Alexandria with great preparation to celebrate the child's birthday, he himself was held back by old age. He tested his sons to see whether any of them wished to go to the king. The elder ones excused themselves, saying they were too rough in manner for such company, and advised sending their brother Hyrcanus instead. Delighted to hear this, he called Hyrcanus and asked whether he was able and willing to go to the king. When Hyrcanus promised to go and said he needed only a modest sum for the journey, since he could live frugally enough that 10,000 drachmas would suffice him, his father was pleased at the boy's good sense. After a short interval, the boy advised his father not to send gifts to the king directly from home, but instead to give him a letter to the steward in Alexandria, instructing him to supply Hyrcanus with money to buy whatever fine and costly things he might find. His father, thinking the expense for the king's gifts would come to 10 talents, and praising his son for the good advice, wrote to the steward Arion, who managed all his funds in Alexandria, no less than 3,000 talents, since Joseph sent the revenues from Syria to Alexandria, and when the deadline approached for paying the king's tribute, he would write to Arion to see to it. So Hyrcanus asked his father for this letter, took it, and set out for Alexandria. As soon as he had left, his brothers wrote to all the king's friends asking them to destroy him. When he arrived in Alexandria and delivered the letter to Arion, the steward asked him how many talents he wished to receive, expecting him to ask for 10 or a little more. But when Hyrcanus said he needed 1,000, Arion grew angry and rebuked him for having resolved to live extravagantly, pointing out how his father had built up his estate through hard labor and self-restraint, and urging him to imitate his father in this. He said he would give him nothing beyond the 10 talents, and that only for gifts to the king. Provoked, the boy had Arion thrown into chains. Arion's wife reported this to Cleopatra and begged her to rebuke the boy, for Arion was held in great honor by her, and Cleopatra made the matter known to the king. Ptolemy sent to Hyrcanus expressing his astonishment that, though sent to him by his father, he had neither come into his presence nor, worse, had thrown the steward into chains. He ordered Hyacinthus to come and explain the reason. Hyacinthus is said to have replied to the king's messenger that there is a law among them forbidding a newborn child to taste of sacrifices before he has gone to the temple and sacrificed to God. On this same reasoning, he himself had not come into the king's presence, waiting instead to bring gifts befitting one who had become his father's benefactor. As for the slave, he had punished him for disobeying his orders, for it makes no difference, he said, whether a master is small or great. If we do not punish such men, you too must expect to be despised by your subjects. Hearing this, Ptolemy burst into laughter and marveled at the boy's greatness of spirit. When Arion learned that the king was disposed in this way and that no help was coming to him, he gave the boy the 1,000 talents and was released from his chains. 3 days later, Hyacinthus paid his respects to the king and queen. They received him gladly and entertained him warmly out of regard for his father. Then, going privately to the merchants, he bought from them 100 boys skilled in letters and in the prime of youth at a talent apiece, and 100 girls at the same price. When he was invited to a banquet at the king's table, along with the leading men of the country, he was placed below everyone, being despised as still a boy by those who assigned the places according to rank. As all the guests reclining there piled up before Hyacinthus the bones of the portions they had eaten, for they stripped off the meat themselves, until the table set before him was heaped full, Trypho, who served as the king's jester and was known for his quips and for raising laughter at drinking parties, stood beside the king, urged on by the other guests, and said, "Do you see, master, the bones piled before Hyacinthus?" From this you may guess that his father stripped all of Syria bare, just as this boy has stripped these bones of their meat. The king laughed at Trypho's remark and asked Hyacinthus why so many bones lay before him. "Naturally, master," he said, "dogs eat the bones along with the meat, just as these men are doing if you look at what lies before them, since nothing remains in front of them. But men eat the meat and throw away the bones, which is what I, being a man, have just done." The king marveled at how clever his answer was and ordered everyone to applaud, welcoming him warmly for his wit. The next day, going to each of the king's friends and to the powerful men at court, he greeted some of them and inquired of their servants what gift they intended to give the king at his son's birthday celebration. When they said that some intended to give 10 talents, others an amount suited to the scale of their own fortunes, he pretended to be distressed at being unable to bring so great a gift, since he had no more than 5 talents. The servants, hearing this, reported it to their masters, who were glad, supposing that Joseph's family would be disgraced and fall out of favor with the king because of the smallness of the gift. When the day arrived, the others brought to the king sums of no more than 20 talents, even from those thought to be giving most generously. But Hyacinthus had the 100 boys, and equally many girls he had purchased carry 1 talent apiece, and brought them forward, presenting the boys to the king and the girls to Cleopatra. Everyone, including the king and queen themselves, marveled at the unexpected extravagance of the gifts, and he further gave gifts worth many talents to the king's friends and to those attending on the king, so as to escape the danger they posed to him. For it was to these very men that his brothers had written asking them to do away with Hyacinthus. Ptolemy, admiring the young man's magnanimity, ordered him to receive whatever gift he wished. He asked for nothing more from the king than that he write to his father and brothers on his behalf. So the king, having honored him most lavishly and given him splendid gifts, wrote to his father and brothers and to all his governors and stewards, and sent him off. When his brothers heard that Hyacinthus had obtained these favors from the king and was returning in great honor, they went out to meet him intending to kill him, and their father knew of it. For he was angry with Hyacinthus over the money spent on the gifts and gave no thought to his safety. Joseph, however, concealed his anger toward his son out of fear of the king. When his brothers joined battle with him, Hyacinthus killed many of those with them, including 2 of his brothers, and the rest escaped safely to Jerusalem to their father. When he came to the city and no one would receive him, he withdrew in fear across the Jordan River and lived there, exacting tribute from the barbarians. At that time Seleucus, surnamed Soter, son of Antiochus the Great, was king of Asia. And Hyacinthus's father Joseph, a good and magnanimous man, who had raised the Jewish people from poverty and weak circumstances to a more splendid state of life, died after holding the tax collectorship of Syria, Phoenicia, and Samaria for 22 years. His uncle Onias also died, leaving the high priesthood to his son Simon. When Simon too died, his son Onias succeeded him in this honor. To this Onias, Arius, king of the Lacedaemonians, sent an embassy and a letter, a copy of which reads as follows. King Arius of the Lacedaemonians to Onias, greetings. We have found in a certain document that the Jews and Lacedaemonians are of one race, being related through Abraham. It is right, therefore, since you are our brothers, that you send to us concerning whatever you wish. We for our part will do the same, and will regard your possessions as our own, and hold what is ours in common with you. Demodals, who carries this letter, will convey your replies to us. The document is drawn up in a square format, and its seal is an eagle grasping a serpent. Such was the content of the letter sent by the king of the Lacedaemonians. After Joseph's death, the people fell into strife over his sons. For the elder sons made war on Hyrcanus, who was the youngest of Joseph's children, and the populace was divided. Most sided with the elder brothers, as did the high priest Simon because of their kinship. But Hyrcanus decided never to return to Jerusalem, and settling across the Jordan, he waged continual war on the Arabs, killing many of them and taking others captive. He built a strong fortress out of white stone, its whole surface, even the roof, carved with enormous animal figures, and around it he ran a great deep moat.